From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Albion College's pandemic pod approach to reopening.
We started early talking with the city about a strategy wherein we wanted to try and create a bubble around the city and the college.
Also, the spectacular show in Michigan skies, courtesy of Western Wildfires. It's also a call to acknowledge the stakes of climate change.
Pollution does not respect borders. Pollution doesn't respect political boundaries. It will migrate in the air. It will get up and travel on these air currents and can impact us again, even though it's thousands of miles away.
And we catch up with recruitment efforts for New Red Order. It's a movement. It's a path to self-help. It's also an art project questioning white people's fascination with Indigenous culture.
We don't want to shut down interest in Indigenous subject matter or Indigenous peoples in the United States, because depending on where you are in the United States, we can be so invisible.
All that just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Have you noticed lately the sun in the evenings looking brilliant or just strange this week? It's the visual effect of smoke traveling 2,500 miles from wildfires on the West Coast.
It's not unlike when you have major volcanic eruptions that also can impact weather and air travel and all sorts of things even far away.
We'll talk about the far reach of large-scale natural disasters later in the program. But first, every college and university in Michigan is choosing among a handful of not great options this fall, trying to offer students the education they paid for while also attempting to get a handle on COVID infections. As you've heard on the show, higher education has proved the new hotspot for outbreaks across Michigan. Albion College is among those. But the college is fighting back with strategies aimed at getting out in front of the virus. Dr. Matthew Johnson is the president of Albion. He joins us now. Dr. Johnson, welcome to Stateside.
I appreciate the opportunity to give a little bit of a perspective about the places that are not the hotspot.
What is it like as a college president to get the news that someone on campus has tested positive?
Well, I have to say the first time I had that news, it was quite anxiety provoking. You have all kinds of thoughts of outbreaks, as well as the danger to that individual and to the broader community. But I have to say several weeks into the semester, the notification that we have another single positive is sort of become a standard business. We have protocols in place to protect that individual as well as the community and manage that case. And that's why we haven't had more than a couple of positive cases at any given time and only have one positive case on campus presently.
Right. We'll talk about a number of different methods, but I guess I wanted to ask you first about the plan of action through which the college is going to encourage students to gather in smaller groups. We've seen in many different college towns around Michigan that a lot of the problems seem to be focused less in places like dormitories and more at informal parties that have happened on and off campus. What's the idea behind the pod strategy?
Well, we, as you may know, are situated in Albion, the city, and we have a pretty close relationship with the city, and the city and the college are surrounded by cornfields, essentially. And so we started early talking with the city about a strategy wherein we wanted to try and create a bubble around the city and the college. We worked closely with the city and the state to establish free public testing for citizens in the city, and that is operating out of one of our facilities here on campus. And then as we brought students back to campus, we had them sign up for an app, the Aura app, which tracks their location initially so that we could track close contacts of people who test positive, but then also so that we could talk with students about the need to establish a perimeter essentially around campus within which we knew we could maintain safety and to limit the amount of free flow back and forth outside of that bubble and talk with anyone who leaves the bubble and comes back so that we can mitigate risk or manage risk. Know where they've gone, know what they've been exposed to, and then work with them to reenter the community in a safe way so that they aren't in danger of reinfecting or infecting the community. So that's what we tried to do, and so far we've been able to work with students to maintain the integrity of that bubble more or less and reduce the number of infections within the bubble.
I know that officials in East Lansing are getting pretty serious about fines and other penalties for large gatherings, which are prohibited at the moment. Will there be sanctions at Albion against students who maybe go outside of their pods?
Well, we've we've fortunately not had to go down that road yet, and really maintained an educational point of view with our students, having good conversations about the risks they pose to themselves and others in the choices that they make. But we have told students that if they consistently violate our public health policies, they will be referred to our student judicial system, which, you know, works just like any other complaint to our student judicial system. There's a process that a student goes through that wherein they can talk about the allegation, and we work through a series of steps to determine whether or not they're responsible, and then would assign the appropriate sanction.
Are you in a position to be able to offer full testing on demand for people, whether or not they have symptoms?
Yes, we have tested every individual, student, faculty, and staff on a 7-day cycle, as well as responsive testing of individuals when a wastewater test comes back positive for a particular residential area. And we've also been able to do responsive testing for athletes who are doing close contact practice. We can test every individual in our campus on demand at any time.
I also read that the college has a plan for tracking infections via wastewater. Tell me about how that works.
Yeah, so several of our largest residential facilities have a common wastewater exit. We've sampled from those wastewater exit pipes every 3 days. Those samples go to a lab. The lab tells us whether there is any viral load in the samples, and we can track whether the viral load is going up or down. And that allows us to then focus our individualized testing on those residential areas that indicate increases in viral load.
What's the difference between doing this on the scale that Albion College is working with, a student body of 1,500 undergrads, I believe, and trying to take preventive measures at some kind of larger school? Could you imagine doing this at a big university?
I really couldn't. And therein lies the fundamental difference between a small liberal arts college and a large university. In the same way that we are providing individualized, high contact, high touch health training, monitoring, and public health approaches, we provide high touch, intensive education. So we already had the infrastructure to be able to do this kind of high touch, high quality, intensive monitoring. But the large universities provide a very different form of education than we do. And so the scaling up of what we do would be very difficult for them to attend to.
All of the things that you've described for us were taken on with the intention of trying to maintain face-to-face instruction. Do you still feel that it's worth both the trouble that you're going to and the potential risk of infection?
I do. And I think it's worth it because of what I hear from parents and students, and because of what I hear from faculty, that they're still having amazing educational experiences in the classroom, outside in the tents, down at the Nature Center, in the gymnasium, in lots of different places and in lots of new ways. And everyone is very thankful that that is happening and grateful. It's not easy. It's an accelerated schedule currently, and that has been challenging for everyone, but it's been overwhelmingly positive response.
Any advice for other schools who maybe want to raise their game a little bit in this area?
I think two things. One, bring your students into the conversation early so that they understand deeply the risk that they present to others and to themselves if they don't follow the public health protocols. We're educational institutions, after all. We should start there. And I think secondly, use technology. We have used technology to be able to help students understand what the boundaries of acceptable behavior are, and to be able to do fast and efficient contact tracing and follow-up testing.
This is quite the moment in higher education, which is a space that has had its challenges predating COVID. Is there anything that you've learned during this time that you think you'll carry forward into Albion's future?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One, I think we're at the moment of a generational shift. I think the Xennials are different than the Millennials. And I think their ability to adapt in the moment to this current crisis is reflective of their childhood and the experiences they had across the last 5 to 7 years with a whole host of social challenges. So that's one learning, I think. A second learning, I think, is that those students are not only ready, willing, and able, but eager to participate in creating communities that are safe both on and off campus. And so I think we need to reevaluate the sort of methods and approaches that we had in a prior generation that were more disciplinary and again, double down on the educational approach.
Dr. Matthew Johnson is president of Albion College in Albion. Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for your time and good luck with the rest of the semester.
Thank you.
Few weeks, it's been easy to focus on how the pandemic is impacting schools and campuses and students, but COVID is still taking its toll on small businesses that have struggled to remain viable with decreased traffic, chief among them, restaurants. This week, we received news that one of the best bagels in Michigan, Detroit Institute of Bagels, is closed for good. The owner hopes to sell the whole business, which is located in the Corktown neighborhood across the street from the famous Old Michigan Central train station. But suffice to say, bagelry, it's not going to be the same. In sunnier news for Eats in the Motor City, vegans of Michigan rejoice. Detroit Vegan Soul is reopening its popular West Village location for curbside pickups. Has your favorite restaurant closed this year? Maybe your favorite bakery has found a new way to do business? Or in some way, the pandemic has actually been a boon for newer products or lines? Tell us what's going on where you eat. Email us at stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up, a public secret society. The New Red Order is recruiting. Do you have what it takes to join?
To be an ally is strictly performative. It's lip service almost by definition. And to be an accomplice is to actually work alongside Indigenous people.
This collective questions mainstream culture's fascination and sometimes fetishization of Indigenous people and culture. We'll meet two of the members next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Starting this weekend, University of Michigan's Penny Stamps Speaker Series is rebooting online. It's an amazing chance to hear creative people presenting their work. Writer Isabel Wilkerson will make an appearance. Also the scientist and designer, Dr. Kate Stone. And also my next guest. The New Red Order is a public secret society facilitated by three core contributors. Michigan brothers Zach and Adam Khalil, who are Ojibwe and grew up in northern Michigan. And the third in the trio is Jackson Paulus. He's Tlingit and grew up in Alaska. Zach Khalil and Jackson Paulus are both joining us via Zoom today. Zach, Jackson, good to have you.
Hey, April, thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
You know, I was reading about how the three of you started working together, and I didn't realize until I did so that the name New Red Order, in addition to the reference people may recognize to conspiracy theories, that this is also a riff on a fraternal society that was populated by white men in the 1800s. Would you tell us a little bit about this order and who they were and how you found out about them?
I grew up with an arm of an organization in my hometown of Ketchikan, Alaska. And I really didn't have any idea what it was, except for that they spelled Tlingit wrong, that it seemed like some Eagles fraternal club, and that they, instead of having a representation of a Tlingit person, had what's could be called a Sioux war bonnet.
In Alaska.
So I found this out in an early age, but didn't really realize until a little bit later in my late teens what the organization was. And later, upon being invited to a party there, found their regalia stashed in their closets for their ceremonial adventures. This was the Improved Order of the Red Men, which claims lineage from the Sons of Liberty, who claim responsibility for the Boston Tea Party, and eventually came to include members such as Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Richard Nixon, didn't allow non-white people in until 1974, and is still continuing with headquarters in Waco, Texas.
So this is a really early example of the kind of performance or alignment with Native people or Native value that goes way back in this country.
Right. And it seems on the front, at least now, kind of ridiculous. But of course, other things in contemporary life seem ridiculous now as well. But you find that this was in a long line of plain Indian in order to become American. So that it was actually very thoroughly embedded in the psyche of what it means to be American. This kind of notion of freedom, this attraction or desire toward freedom that would set one apart from a dictator. And employing the notion, the tactics of what could be called savage warfare in a so-called Revolutionary War context.
I was going to say, so just one of our main aims and thinking about the New Red Order, sort of in contradistinction to the Improved Order of the Red Men, is since the Improved Order of the Red Men still exists, we wanted to create a different organization, a sort of alternative that may have less destructive impact and actually one that sort of looks towards the future as opposed to sort of being mired in the past.
But which may confront and be complicated by desires for indigeneity, which persist back to that time and mode of mimicry.
So one of the works that you're going to be presenting is a short film that she made called Never Settle, Calling In. And it functions as a sort of recruitment video that is not presented exactly as tongue-in-cheek, but definitely has some satirical elements. Can you explain what's happening in it?
Yeah, well, I think you'll be able to get a greater understanding of what's happening when viewing the video. But as you mentioned, the Never Settle Calling In does function as the first step in a series of stages toward recruitment into the Public Secret Society, New Red Order, which it devotes itself to examining desires for indigeneity. Now, the ways that can be done can vary, but overall, the NRO is investigated to providing a safe space that can act as a facilitation ground for focusing on desires that one might find in oneself towards indigeneity that may be seen as potentially inappropriate, but which also pervade the myths, dreams, and political foundations of the so-called Americas. This is an introduction into what that might be and the full program in terms of what might occur in initiation with the New Red Order can be found in the further Never Settle video, which is in the Museum of Contemporary Art exhibition.
We should say this is part of this larger campaign that you've presented in a number of artworks that you've shown. There are things like online questionnaires, and there have been some in-person events when that was possible. And it, like you say, it flips the desire that, you know, some white Americans have shown again and again throughout history to connect with something spiritual or essential through a connection with Native culture. And I love the idea of it being treated as sort of a tryout or an interview. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how these ideas congealed into this kind of presentation for you?
I think to talk about that, it might be useful to go back to one of our earlier works, and not to say, which is a film my brother and I made about the Seven Fires Prophecy and our tribe up in the UP of Michigan, and notice that there was this real desire for these sort of indigenous epistemologies or worldviews or ways of thinking. But that desire was often extractive. It was something that non-indigenous people wanted to take from indigenous people and not necessarily give anything back. As filmmakers operating in museums and universities and film festivals, we were often asked to be informants in the typical anthropological sense on our community.
People saying, tell us about the Native experience.
Yeah, tell us about the Native experience. Tell us about your tribe. Tell us something that'll be useful to us that we can use. You know, there's a long history of that being an extractive, negative thing for indigenous communities in the Americas, especially in relation to the moving image. That's something we're always really concerned about. At the same time, we don't want to shut down interest in indigenous subject matter or indigenous peoples in the United States, because depending on where you are in the United States, we can be so invisible. You know, we don't want to shut down interest in indigeneity, but we also want to make sure that interest manifests in a way that actually benefits indigenous people and not just non-indigenous people in a reciprocal way. So in a big way for us, starting the New Red Order, this organization, this public secret society, is a way of calling people into that process of codifying our role as informants, acknowledging that no matter what, as filmmakers, as artists who work in these non-Indigenous spheres, oftentimes in universities, that we do have to act as informants. And since that seems to be so unavoidable and that desire for indigeneity is so deep in the heart of this country and its foundation, that if we can't get around that, then to think about how we can utilize that, how we can channel that desire into forms that actually benefit Indigenous people. And so for us, these sort of like the calling in, you can go to our website, newredorder.org, and join and become a member of this public secret society by informing on yourself and your own culture and your own desires for indigeneity. So in a big way, it's acknowledging that we as Native artists have to act as informants, and then asking our audience, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to inform along with us on their own cultures.
I really appreciate your use of the phrase calling in. A lot of us are at this point pretty familiar with the phrase in the context of like call out culture, but I think people may not be as familiar with calling in. Can you sort of explain what's meant by that?
Yeah. Well, you find that in a lot of the desire for indigeneity, which may manifest as inappropriate, could occur in instances such as Standing Rock, where there was calling out of people who went along to help advocate for water as life, that those activities might have potentially been seen by Indigenous people as extractive or as missing the point of decolonization. So we find that the use of satirical modes can act as a calling out, which first has to function as an acknowledgement. Because if there is not a calling out, then you're not actually taking the problematicity of that seriously. But when that acknowledgement can kind of function in a loop or get going, then you also recognize that the calling out can function as a further obstruction to desiring indigeneity, because people feel that they can't advocate or express any interest without doing something inappropriate or without overstepping. So we find that employing these hues of unfolding satiricality or something like that can act as a way of calling in, because then you find that we, alongside with them, can acknowledge the humor and kind of ludicrousness of the entire situation in which we're so invisibilized.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Zach Khalil, who grew up in Michigan, and Jackson Paulus. They're members of the Public Secret Society, New Red Order. And they'll be presenting as part of the Penny Stamps Lecture Series this weekend. Another part of your work has involved an online questionnaire that offers up questions like, are you interested in learning how to contribute to Indigenous growth? You know, just pretty straightforward. And then, are you interested in informing on your own culture? If so, describe your ideal level of commitment. And again, that is sort of a practical question that brings the more satirical edge into it. I was thinking about the way that white people sometimes look at Native people to sort of gauge how much they might measure up to a colonial standard of what Native people are like. It feels like in posing these questions, part of what you're doing is flipping the script and asking, you know, people who aren't part of Native culture, who are trying to be allies, you know, if they are performing something in turn. Was that something that was on your mind when you were making the film and in some of these other works that you've used to explore this?
Yes, definitely the performance of the desire for indigeneity and the uncertainty around that is something that's always on our minds. And again, as Zach mentioned, it's coming from a place of understanding ourselves as informants. So that if we can acknowledge our own complicity or our own role in that and the own complications around that, then we find that there is potential for us to examine and acknowledge the kind of awkwardness that might occur with attempting to move toward desires for indigeneity that may occur not just from white people, but from any realm, Indigenous people included, who are attempting to understand their own background or inheritance.
Right.
And which, you know, I think the New Red Order is focused a lot on the sort of performance of indigeneity, but also in a big way is really thinking about the performance of allyship, as you were talking about. And the New Red Order makes like a really important distinction between sort of allies and accomplices, based on a text from an Indigenous Media Action Group that we're big fans of. And they draw a distinction between allies and accomplices, where for decolonial struggles in the United States and in a settler colonial context, to be an ally is strictly performative. It's lip service almost by definition. And to be an accomplice is to actually work alongside Indigenous people. And thinking about the word accomplice is a person who helps another commit a crime. But decolonization, a truly decolonial act, has to be against the law in a settler colonial context. So that's another distinction that we like to draw.
The visual style for your projects have so much going on in them. There are elements, and this is true of Inaatse for sure, there are elements of documentary, but also collage scenes and set pieces that you create, sometimes illustration. Is the density of your work product, is that something that you build in on purpose or just something that has evolved as you get going and figure out the rhythms that you're going for?
That density is really an intrinsic, intentional part of our practice and our process, ranging from Inaatse to our work with the New Red Order. And I think a lot of that for us is speaking to multiple audiences at the same time and sort of trying to code a film vertically, layers on top of each other, as opposed to sort of horizontally over time. At any one moment or period of the film, there are a lot of visual layers going on, and then also conceptually, there are a lot of layers going on that speak to different audiences, both like my own tribe in the EP, at the Sisimri tribe of Chippewa Indians, speaking to Ojibwe people in general, Anishinaabe people, Native American people, Indigenous people, non-Indigenous people, the sort of like onions of different audiences that the film is crafted for. And I think that that visual style sort of speaks to that. And then also, I think we're really interested in thinking about the ways that film and the moving image has been used as a tool against Indigenous people for so long through the sort of extractive, destructive impulses of visual anthropology and ethnography, and trying to come up with, you know, how there's different forms of like national cinema, like Japanese cinema or French cinema, mm-hmm. trying to think about what an Anishinaabe or Ojibwe form of cinema would be and how that could be coded into a different cinematic language.
And I think for the New Red Order films, the kind of density is amplified even further because we're, you know, speaking to multiple audiences, but also speaking about different forms of ingestion or appropriation. And so by utilizing and mimicking those same forms, we are able to kind of collapse modalities into a way that can hopefully speak to multiple audiences, like Zach mentioned.
Our ideas about narrative are so shaped by culture and language. I do remember as a teenager picking up a collection of Anishinaabe stories that had been published in Canada, and I just wasn't prepared, you know, like I didn't understand the story forms, which is neither here nor there, except that that was the first time it occurred to me that someone who grew up with a different idea about even sentence structure or myth might encounter something like the Brothers Grimm and, you know, just like not really find anything to relate to. Could you each talk a little bit about influences on your own sense of story?
Yeah, Zach here. I mean, I think for me and my brother in particular, being Ojibwe, that oral tradition is really important to us. And also to think about not only how stories are structured, but why they're structured that way and what's their intention, what's the use of stories besides entertainment or education. And for us, I think, and not to say the film that's going to be playing tonight is a great example of that.
What's much more an artifact of a modern sensibility.
Yeah, in some ways, but also a very traditional sensibility both. And I think that those two things aren't necessarily in opposition in any way whatsoever. But not to say the film is based upon the Seven Fires prophecy, which is like an ancient Anishinaabe story and prophecy that's been passed throughout the generations that has many different versions and many different interpretations of what it means. But fundamentally, it's a story that both predates and predicts the arrival of Europeans in the Americas, and a story that seeks to guide the Anishinaabe people through this and into the future in ways that are hopefully more productive and helpful for Anishinaabe people in general. So it's also a story that's like linear and nonlinear. It moves through time. In a way, it's a way of manifesting history in the present to serve the future. And I think that that's a really intrinsic part of the way that we think about storytelling, the kinds of stories we tell and what they're for.
Yeah. And I think with the moving into the potential narrative devices one might recognize in Never Settle Calling In, which of course is an introductory video and doesn't have the time to expand into the narrative in a way, I think the sense of story does refer in large part to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the collapse, the density of information, where in Tlingit oral history, you always find that there are citations that continually interrupt the flow of the story. So I think some of that is filtering in, at least into the New Red Order material.
Mm-hmm. I think also to follow up on that, specifically with Never Settled Calling In, you know, it is a recruitment video in the typical sort of commercial capitalistic sense, where it's almost an advertisement or an infomercial or a cult indoctrination video. It's kind of trying to blur the distinction between all those things and kind of taking bits of style from each of them. And part of that is also just to acknowledge the ways in which indigeneity is often, you know, twisted and used for in commercial ways and sold, but trying to utilize that for hopefully better ends in the long run, to kind of call people in to think more critically about how and why they want to engage with Indigenous people and their own settler colonial realities.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Zach Khalil and Jackson Paulus of New Red Order. They're presenting work as part of the Stamps Speaker Series this weekend. And there may be more of their work on view in Michigan soon. More in a moment after a short break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're talking with Zach Khalil and Jackson Paulus of New Red Order. They're artists, but their work occupies a corner of the art world in which interactions with other people are central to the work. New Red Order is a public secret society. They create videos, conceptual pieces, sometimes events that are designed to get people thinking about what it means to be an Indigenous person today and what it would take to move the needle, giving Indigenous people more agency in their own lives. They're presenting Friday night as part of the Penny Stamps Speaker Series. And as we'll hear, they may have an exhibition opening in Detroit soon. Let's get back to the conversation. Could you both say a few words about how you settled into visual and conceptual art as the kind of place to say the things that you wanted to say?
Yeah, I'll go Jackson here. I'm coming from Alaska. My father, Nathan Jackson, was a kind of a renowned Tlingit carver in the Northwest Coast. So I grew up under him working. I grew up behind stanchions for boatloads of tourists coming in on buses into Saxman Native Village to watch Native people carve. I grew up with a simultaneous inheritance of that culture and a desire to move it forward and to continue it, but also an uncomfortability with the way that that was continually digested. And so I began an art career, partly because, I mean, it's not that all that I knew how to do at the time, but it's what I realized, like, were certain gifts or potentialities that I had that wouldn't be able to express in other modes.
How about you, Zach?
You know, I grew up watching way too many movies and TV, and that shaped who I am in a big way, for better or for worse. And I think as I grew up, I was able to realize how much that was the case. And that gave me a real interest in learning how to edit, learning how to make visual media, whether film or television, and to sort of see some of the codes and logic that are embedded in that form, and to be able to sort of reverse engineer that for myself. And then also thinking again about the ways that the moving image has played such a crucial role in the way that people think about Indigenous peoples in the Americas was always really important to me. I was really drawn to visual media because of its power and its ability to say things that you can't say in any other way, and that leave room for ambiguity and paradox. But they can also open up a more profound space to contemplate some really difficult realities.
Right. New Red Order has managed to carve out space to show your work amid institutions. And sometimes that means interacting with places like art galleries and art museums, which have behaved in really damaging ways to Native people and Native artifacts, probably more times than we can count. Is it harder to find institutions that you feel you can work with and feel okay about?
Zach, that's a really good question. I would say I don't think we've ever really felt that way, that we ever feel really comfortable with the institutions we're working with generally. Mm-hmm. There's always a few exceptions here or there. But, you know, people talk about decolonization as a sort of catch-all term for improving institutions or schools. But I think it's interesting to think about, like, how can you decolonize a colonial institution, such as like a university or that's a museum of natural history. And I would argue that you probably can't, you know, you kind of have to tear it down in the first place. And I realize that's probably not a popular opinion. But to that sense, like, we don't necessarily think that any of the institutions that we work with have a clean bill of health or are necessarily ethical. But in our engagement with them, we try to utilize that their platform and their resources to call attention to the ways in which they and the society that creates them is not ethical and does need to change. I think as informants, if we were only willing to collaborate with institutions that we thought were ethically impervious, I don't think there would be anybody to collaborate with, almost, hate to say it.
Sad commentary. You were actually in that situation a couple of months ago when Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit came under fire for the way that its director at the time was treating staff, and specifically people of color who were on staff and curators who the museum worked with. You had a show scheduled there that sort of went on hold. And I just wondered if you've made any decisions about whether you're going to go forward doing some work with them.
So we had a show, our first solo museum exhibition, that was set to open on July 9th at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. Mm-hmm. And there was a resistance amongst the staff to executive leadership, in particular at the museum, as well as sort of long list of other grievances and concerns, all of which were very legitimate. So, you know, we were in a fortunate position where we became aware of this before our show opened. The staff had a list of five action items or demands which they wanted the museum to meet, in particular changing the director. And all those demands to us seemed very reasonable. And we were in a unique position before the show opened where, as artists, we had power that the staff didn't have necessarily. So we wanted to utilize the power that we had to essentially tell the institution that they couldn't open the show until they agreed to meet all of the staff's demands. You know, we're currently in negotiations with the institution still, but it's, you know, it's really up to the museum board and the decisions that they're willing to make to reformulate their institution to be more accountable to its community. And I also just do want to say that we've worked with a lot of really amazing people at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. And although the leadership was not in a good place, there are a lot of great people that work there, and a lot of amazing people in the community. And that we're also incredibly proud of the show that we were able to put together there and really want people in Detroit and all over Michigan and the area to come see it.
Jackson, Zach, your work is always concerned with not just pointing out, you know, the obstacles to Native people having more agency in their lives and some growth, but in figuring out ways to expand that. Do you think it's possible to harness all these trappings of performance, you know, the feather tattoos, the dream catchers, the sage bundles, in some way that is truly helpful to Native people?
I mean, I think those things that you just referenced are generally, and I think that's why you reference them, are generally, you know, superficial. They're sort of easily digestible symbols.
And made into commodities, easy to buy and sell.
Exactly. And commodities that are perfectly suited towards our particularly insane existential environmental catastrophe, where, like, there are commodities that are supposed to be easily consumed to make people feel like they're engaging with indigeneity and something more authentic. I hate that word. So yeah, I don't necessarily think that those things are ways of engaging with indigeneity that can actually be particularly helpful or useful to indigenous people. On the other hand, I think there are symbols that certain non-indigenous people respond to and are drawn to. And I think, you know, they can be used in a sort of bait and switch, perhaps, to get people who might be interested in a more superficial engagement to actually think critically about their own relationship to indigeneity and settler colonialism.
One way that people can pursue their indigeneity or to find more is to go to newredorder.org or potentially call the hotline 1-888-NEW-RED-1.
It's a toll-free hotline, 1-888-NEW-RED-1. The thing that I want to kind of foreground this all with is that the New Red Order is, in some sense, is a provocation, and in a larger sense, is the beginning of a larger conversation. We don't pretend to have answers to a lot of these questions, but they're questions that we think we all need to start asking each other and start talking about and thinking through together. And so, yeah, I just want to really highlight that fact, that this isn't something that's complete in any way whatsoever. That's the start of, you know, a long process that is going to take generations. But that we just want to try to think of ways to get around some of these obstructions to actually engaging thoughtfully, directly, critically with these questions. And I mean that really genuinely, really interested in what people out there think about all of this, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people.
Zach Khalil and Jackson Paulus are part of New Red Order, and they're leading off the Penny Stamps Distinguished Speaker Series for the University of Michigan Stamp School of Art and Design. Their webcast is starting tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Audiences can also tune in and join the conversation on the archive series for the page. Zach, Jackson, it's been really nice talking to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for the question.
We live in a time in human history when it's possible to maintain very intimate connections with people and places that are thousands of miles away. And if, like me, you know someone in the West Coast or in the Rockies, it's been almost impossible to get through this week without a deep sense of grief about the fire season that's raging out of control west of the Mississippi. Friends and family have lost homes or a lifetime of possessions. People have died. And entire towns that I've visited in my prior life in Oregon have been completely wiped out, burned to the ground. Maybe you don't know anyone out there, but you have been noticing the haze over Michigan this week. We're calling up Nick Schreck today to talk about this. He's an associate dean at University of Detroit Mercy, and his field is environmental law. Nick, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
We hear that our air quality has not, in any official sense, been impacted by the West Coast fires, but I got to say, the sun definitely looks different this week. Do you know what's happening?
Well, right. So we are actually, we're seeing the haze, which is the smoke from the wildfires in the West. The Pacific Northwest in particular is what is sort of, you know, blowing and wafting into our direction. So we're seeing that, and that haze that's blocking out the sun is from the wildfires. But in terms of air quality that we're breathing on the ground, we haven't seen, you know, really noticeable upticks in harmful air quality that we're measuring at monitoring points around Southeast Michigan.
How far has smoke from the West Coast traveled, if we're seeing it here?
Well, thousands of miles. I didn't plug that into my GPS, but right. I mean, definitely it's over. I mean, just think about the distance, right? It's traveled over the Rocky Mountains, over the plains, now over the Great Lakes and here into Southeast Michigan. And they're continuing to see even impacts of the wildfire smoke on the East Coast. So pretty dramatic how far it's traveled.
How unusual is it for smoke to travel that far?
Well, it is unusual for us to see smoke from other states and certainly from the western United States or western Canada, but it does happen. And when you have these large, you know, many millions of acres of fires that are burning, it does create a lot of smoke, and it's something that does travel very far and we can pick up on satellite imagery. It's not unlike when you have major volcanic eruptions that also can impact weather and air travel and all sorts of things even far away. You might remember a couple years ago there was a volcanic eruption in Iceland that impacted air travel all over Europe. So it's not uncommon for this type of thing to happen.
Right. Nick, I read that you taught in China for a while, and that's certainly a country that's had to deal with its own issues in terms of poor air quality. Could you describe the effect of trying to live and work in a highly polluted air environment and just what the effect is on society as a whole?
Well, a lot of the impacts were similar. So I was in Xi'an, China, which is central China, in a very industrial area where we would often have air quality alerts that were similar to what is occurring now in Portland and in Seattle and in California, meaning that there's very high levels of particulate matter in the air. And these are really fine particles, like dust particles, that they actually get lodged in our lungs. We don't respirate them out or breathe them out. And so over time, they can be harmful to your health. So it's actually, I was just reflecting on this the other day, that 6 years ago when I was in China, I was regularly wearing a mask when I was out in public or going for walks. And I had a mask that had a fine filter similar to the N95 masks that we've heard so much about now with COVID-19. But the idea was to prevent those fine particles from entering into your nose or your mouth and then into your lungs. And so it's something that's noticeable, and it's also the air has a heaviness to it, and particularly for people with asthma or with other breathing difficulties, it can be just very hard to even go about your day, to run to the grocery store or to do errands, because the air, it's actually physically harder to breathe when it's so laden with particles like the smoke from the wildfires or smoke from a smokestack from a factory.
President Trump has maintained that what's happening in the West right now is not about climate change, that it's about poor forest management. Forest management definitely is a hot topic out West. What do you think of the arguments that the fire-prone areas of the United States aren't being maintained in the best way with respect to the natural fire cycle?
Well, I think there's certainly more that we could do to make sure that undergrowth and fallen trees, dead trees that are laying on the forest floor, cleaning that up, making sure that it's properly maintained is something that we should continue to work towards. But remember, these are millions of acres of often federal land, but there's also state land and private land. And so to do that kind of intensive clearing and just making sure that you're keeping brush and undergrowth cut down, it's an intensive amount of labor and a lot of effort, and it would cost a great deal of money to do that. I do think it's a smart thing to do to continue to manage our forests effectively to try and reduce fires, and then to actually let smaller fires burn occasionally. I mean, that's something that from indigenous people that were living in the Western United States and Western Canada pre-colonial settlement, they would regularly have forest fires and set them and let them burn to continue to clean out that underbrush. So that's something that I think we could learn. But climate change is definitely a factor. I mean, we are seeing warmer, drier conditions year over year in the American and Canadian West, and that is continuing to dry out these forests and to lead to the type of situation where we have now, where it's really just a tinderbox, and with some hot, dry weather, and whether it's, man-made fires or lightning strikes, they can just burn out of control.
Do you expect that we might see some climate-driven migration within the continental U.S. within the near term?
Well, it's certainly something that planners are looking at, city planners, state planners, thinking about how people may change their habits, but also where they live. And so when we think about climate migrants, there has been this idea, this notion that people that have maybe relocated to the Western United States or the South in the United States, that they may start looking for cooler, wetter climates, like here in Michigan. And there's even some states and cities that are looking at this as an economic growth opportunity. Buffalo, New York, actually has done a lot of research into looking at how they can attract people who, maybe tired of having to constantly flee from forest fires or just from the dry, oppressive heat that is often occurring now in other parts of the country.
Are there ways we should be thinking about fires and the related natural disasters in a different way in the public space?
No, I mean, I think I would just say that for air quality, right now we're not seeing, dramatic spikes in particulate matter pollution that people are breathing in, but it's something to keep an eye on, because as air currents change, and if you get maybe a directional shift in the wind, we could potentially see ground level impacts from the Western wildfires. And so it's something that I know that the state Environment, Great Lakes and Energy Office is keeping an eye on. And we just have to make sure that we're tracking that, because we could have poor air quality, and that would mean that we would encourage people to stay inside, keep their windows shut, that type of thing.
What kind of ground level effects are you talking about? Like just the AQI index might actually change?
Correct. Like depending on just whether it's pressure in the atmosphere, the way that the wind is blowing, that's one thing that we just need to keep an eye on, is that you could potentially see an increase in particulate matter pollution from those Western wildfires. It's unlikely that would be at a level that's harmful for us here in Michigan. But again, it's just something to keep an eye on. And I think a reminder that pollution does not respect borders. Pollution doesn't respect political boundaries. It will migrate in the air. It will get up and travel on these air currents and can impact us, again, even though it's thousands of miles away.
Nick Schreck is an associate dean at University of Detroit Mercy. His field is environmental law and policy. Nick, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk to us about this.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.